I'm always going to have respect for Triple H. At WrestleMania, Triple H was man enough to stand up and shake my hand after he beat me. And at Night of Champions, I'm going to prove that on his best day, Seth Rollins is not half the man that Triple H is.
You're not bilingual?
Huh?
You're not bilingual?
There's a lot of bi things I am, but lingual's not one of them. Hey, wait a minute. Did I just mean to say that?
I don't think you did, but be that as it may, we're live.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Happy Labor Day weekend. This is episode 399 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 6, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. Summer's over. Very depressing. What's not depressing is the podcast that I did with Steve from the Fans Podcast. He had me on this week to review In Your House Season's Beatings from December 1995. It's part of a little series he does where he goes back on the network and reviews a whole bunch of old pay-per-views. And what a show it was, with the future owner of the company rolling around in pig shit, Balls Mahoney dressed up as Santa Claus beating up Savio Vega. And not for nothing, actually, a hell of a main event between Bret Hart and the British Bulldog. Very bloody main event. Of all the things on the network that you could possibly choose from, I don't know why you would watch this show, but you can listen to our review as you watch it, get some perspective on what was going on at that time in WWE and why certain things happened the way they did. So you can go to thefanspodcast.com, click on the Monday Night War section, and you will find it in there. Or you can find the direct link on my Twitter and my Facebook pages. Thank you for everybody who's continued to sign up for our Audible trial using our URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster. One of the best ways to support the show is just sign up for a free trial, get yourself a free audiobook. They have a 30-day trial membership that you could sign up for. You get one free book, and even if you cancel during the trial period, you get to keep that book. Of course, the new Daniel Bryan book, the Yes book, is up in there, as well as the books for Shawn Michaels, Chris Jericho, and a whole bunch of other people. But check out the Bryan book. I've heard, I continue to hear great things about it, and I promise I will get to that one of these days. audibletrial.com/solomonster. Please use our URL when you sign up. And in doing so, you are helping the podcast. And also, speaking of helping the podcast, you can make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. Thank you to No Mercy, Nick Horacek, Deadpool James Herrera, Light 'Em Up Lamont Ambler, Extraordinary Xavier Hacking, David Sold Out Solus, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, Scorpion Scott Kina, Jerome You're Going Down Eugenio, Slice and Dice Philip Kruger, Master Blaster Samarth Gupta, the Hispanic Panic, Alicia Martinez, who, I am told, is celebrating a birthday today, or at least so says her fiancé, so happy birthday, Alicia. Music Man Brad Hamlin, who is part of a band called Tuesday Morning Wrestling that has a new album out, which is free. It's a free album to download online. You can give it a listen at tuesdaymorningwrestling.bandcamp.com. They actually have a new track they worked on called Horseman Business. It's about Ric Flair and Arn Anderson. It's not on that album. Maybe I'll play it later in the show. We'll see.
WWE star Jimmy Snuka made a name with his flashy moves in the wrestling ring, but tonight he's out on bond in New Jersey accused of killing his girlfriend 3 decades ago.
So if this was such an easy indictment, why did it take so long to get it? The Allentown Morning Call is reporting the case went cold after WWE executive Vince McMahon got involved. Tonight that organization expressed its, quote, continued sympathy to the Argentino family for their loss.
This was one of the busiest wrestling news weeks we've had in a long time, and to me, there was no story bigger than this one, and that's what we're going to lead off with here. Superfly Jimmy Snuka, 72 years old, diagnosed about a month ago with stomach cancer, was charged on Tuesday with third-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter in the 1983 death of his then-girlfriend slash mistress, Nancy Argentino. She was 23 years old at the time that she died. Third-degree murder implies that it was intentional, with no prior intent to kill. Crimes of passion, you know, is another phrase they sometimes use for it. I've talked about this case at least twice before here on The Sound Off. I'm going to talk about a lot of this stuff here, so you don't really have to go back in the archives, but if you want to, you can listen to Sound Off 293 from September 2013. That was the show where I listed the, remember the three questions I did? If I could ask Vince McMahon three questions, just in general, like what would they be? I said that one of them would be, if I could, I would ask him, you know, what was in the briefcase? And I went into some detail about what that meant and about the case. And I also talked about the Snuka stuff at length in January of last year, 2014, on Sound Off Episode 312, about an hour into the show. TV Tracks actually just posted the clip from that show yesterday on his channel, so you can check it out there or just go back in the archives. A family friend of mine was close with Nancy. I mentioned that back on that episode 312. Nancy was from an Italian family in Brooklyn, and that's where they met. They became friends. And, you know, the friend always thought that Snuka was guilty. You couldn't even say his name around her for the longest time. You know, I knew that back when I was even younger, not to do that. And I told her about what happened after this news broke. This was before it got picked up everywhere, and it was plastered on the cover of the Daily News here in New York. You know, I filled her in on what had happened, and her reaction was relief, as you would imagine. You know, finally, justice for this girl. I mean, real justice would be seeing this guy behind bars, but it really is just justice to see him formally charged after 32 years. A lot of people never thought they would see the day. I'm sure Snuka never thought he would see the day. So if you don't know the story, Snuka and Argentino were staying at a motel in Allentown, Pennsylvania. WWE used to tape a lot of television back then in Allentown. They would have these marathon TV tapings. Snuka came back to his room after the show. He found Nancy on the bed. She was gasping for air. She was oozing yellow fluid from her nose and her mouth. She died the next day. The autopsy showed that she died of traumatic brain injuries, okay, a fractured skull. She had cuts and bruises all over her body that they said were consistent with what they believed to be signs of domestic abuse. The autopsy said her head was likely struck by a stationary object, which would make sense if the story is that she hit her head on something, fell and hit her head on something. And the pathologist wrote that the case should be investigated as a homicide until proven otherwise. And here's where things get very murky and get very suspicious. The DA's office would not allow for the release of the autopsy report. Now, I don't know if the law works differently in the state of Pennsylvania when it comes to this kind of stuff. We've seen other examples of this. You know, a few months ago, the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore that was all over the news here when, you know, the police arrested a black man, they threw him in a police van, he somehow ended up getting his neck snapped, and he died. The prosecutor there blocked the release of Freddie Gray's autopsy report, which ended up getting leaked anyway, because in today's day and age, even if you try to hide something, it's inevitable, it's going to get leaked. So it got leaked out, but there were accusations that, you know, her blocking its release, it was politically motivated because they might find things in there that would hurt their case against the police officers involved. I don't know what her motivations may or may not have been in doing that. I don't want to get into a whole black versus white argument here because that's not what this is about. But there have been times where an autopsy comes out and you have people all over cable news and all over the news media basically, you know, basically they're litigating the case on the air. That's just, it's a byproduct of having the 24/7 news cycle, right? That's what court TV was all about and probably still is. Nancy Grace and all the other bozos who go on the air and they litigate these cases on the air before they're actually litigated in court. So that could potentially taint the jury pool before the case even goes to trial. Maybe that's what happened in the beginning here. You know, that was their fear, and so they didn't want the report to come out. They blocked the release of it because it made Snuka look bad, and he's a celebrity, and if he's charged and this thing goes to trial, it could be bad for Jimmy Snuka. Maybe that's what happened. I don't personally buy that. I think this thing stinks to high holy hell. The problem is that the case just went cold and no charges were ever filed and the case was never closed. It's been open, technically, all of these years. If they closed the case, there would be no issue releasing the autopsy. So for 30 years, this report was kept hidden away out of public view. The local newspaper there, Morning Call, wrote a long story about the case 2 years. It was 2 years ago. Yeah, it was the 30th anniversary. They're researching their story. They were finally able to get a copy of the autopsy. And that finding in the autopsy that they thought it should be tried as a homicide was finally made public after all these years. And so between that and at the urging of Nancy's family, the DA finally agreed to re-examine the case, and he initiated a grand jury investigation, and that's where we are today. Snuka was not arrested at his home. There were some initial reports that said he was arrested in New Jersey at his home. That's not true. He turned himself in. He showed up in a wheelchair with a feeding tube. He was arraigned. His ex-wife, who for whatever reason was there with him and his current wife when they wheeled him in, she posted part of the $100,000 bail that was set. She posted bond so that he could be released. Sure enough, and you knew this was coming, his lawyer is claiming that Snuka is suffering from partial dementia from decades of head injuries, and therefore he may not be fit to stand trial. This is Vinny the Chin Gigante all over again. Soon we'll be hearing stories of Snuka wandering down the street in his wrestling tights looking for Roddy Piper. Or should I say wheeling himself down the street. Anyway, he has a preliminary hearing set for September 21st. That date's going to get pushed back because he has to find a new lawyer. His current one, I think, has another case. He can't do this one. At that hearing, the judge will determine if there's enough evidence for him to stand trial. On that third-degree murder charge alone in the state of Pennsylvania, the mandatory sentence is 20 to 40 years. I don't think there's a chance in hell he's getting anything close to that, though, if he gets anything at all. But that's, in the state of Pennsylvania, that's typically what you could get for a third-degree murder charge. There is no statute of limitations on murder in most states. I've gotten a lot of tweets about that, mainly from people who don't live in this country and don't know the laws, or people who do live in this country and don't know the laws. And I've been reading up on some stuff I didn't even know, but there are some exceptions. I can't say that there, you know, it's an absolute rule. There is no statute of limitations on murder because, believe it or not, in some states there actually may be a statute of limitations. But by and large, there is no statute. You know, you can't murder somebody 20, 30, 40 years ago and then pop your head up all these years later and say, hey, I got away with murder, and expect to get away with it. You know, murder is one of those things you generally cannot get away with simply by virtue of how much time has gone by. That's not how this works. There was never a doubt in my mind that he killed his girlfriend. I always thought the guy was guilty of sin. In Snuka's book, he denies ever even hurting Nancy, not even once. That's a lie. There was another incident only a few months before this happened where they were in another hotel. The hotel manager had to call the cops because he was assaulting her. The police report says that he was naked. He was dragging her down the hallway by her hair. She may have been naked too. It took 9 sheriff's deputies, 9, and 2 police dogs just to get the second handcuff on him. They only got one. To get the second one, they needed backup. He pushed one of the cops against the wall. They said he had almost superhuman strength, they said. Wearing nothing but his underwear. I stand corrected. He was wearing his underwear. Now picture that in your head. That's quite a scene. But he said he never hurt her. So I guess the witnesses and the responding officers, they're all liars. The grand jury came to the conclusion that Snuka repeatedly assaulted Nancy at the motel on the day she died. Well, technically, she died the next day. And he didn't bother getting her to a hospital in time, or else they actually may have been able to save her life. Nancy's family sued Snuka for a wrongful death a few years after this happened. They won a $500,000 judgment against him. He never paid. He claimed he was broke. To this day, I don't think he's paid one red cent. Read the newspaper story from June of 2013. It's on the Morning Call website. It's a long story, like 6 pages long, but it has a ton of information about this whole case. Snuka told 5 different people at the time, I think the night this happened, 5 different people, including the responding officer, that he shoved Nancy earlier in the day. She fell. She hit her head. Later, he told police, oh, those 5 people, brother, they misunderstood me. She slipped and hit her head, brother, when we stopped on the side of the road to go to the bathroom. You know, it's interesting how his story changed after she died in the emergency room, because he was there watching them work on her, and she was still alive, and she was telling, again, those initial five people the story about what happened, and then she died. They couldn't save her life, and all of a sudden, his story changed to her slipping on the side of the road and hitting her head. There were so many inconsistencies in his stories. He couldn't keep his story straight. He had like three or four different versions of what happened, depending on, you know, when you talk to him. That was the biggest convincing factor for the grand jury to indict him. They also interviewed some new witnesses. They spoke to the widow of Buddy Rogers. Buddy Rogers was Snuka's manager back then. Not on camera, but he would handle a lot of his travel and his affairs behind the scenes, getting from town to town. He would drive with him. I think Buddy Rogers' family, I think he and his wife may have actually lived next door to the Snukas at one point. So Buddy Rogers' widow testified that Snuka assaulted his wife later that same year. This was only a few months after the Argentino incident. You know, the wife came knocking on their door. Her face was battered and bloodied. I think Buddy Rogers' wife took pictures of the abuse. And Snuka's ex-wife testified as well, basically backed up the whole story that, yes, Jimmy beat me up. I mean, really, really damning stuff that the grand jury heard. Now, there was a follow-up interview with Snuka back in June of 83. So this was only a few weeks, maybe 3 weeks or so after she died. This was the meeting that Vince McMahon attended. There's been a lot of questions and speculation about his involvement over the years. Remember, I talked about the briefcase. Snuka, in his book, said that Vince McMahon brought a briefcase with him to the meeting. It's one of the only things he remembers. He remembers that. If I'm Vince McMahon, I'm not happy about what Jimmy Snuka said in that book. You know, put it that way. The assistant DA at the time was part of that meeting with Snuka and Vince. And he said that Vince did all the talking. He was a showman. He was, you know, very charismatic. Again, he controlled, tried to steer the conversation during the meeting. But as far as what was actually said, you know, the assistant DA says he couldn't remember any specifics of the conversation. Snuka, of course, says he doesn't remember much about the conversation. After that meeting, what we do know is the case went cold and no charges were ever filed. I doubt there was a money in the bank contract in that briefcase. That alone is enough to make you wonder. I mean, it doesn't make Vince guilty of anything, but it does. Look, it gives people a reason to be suspicious. And here's the other thing about the briefcase stuff that makes it so interesting to me. I mean, maybe not to other people, but to me it does. And I mentioned this on Sound Off 293, okay, almost 2 years ago. And I don't think this is something any other podcast has brought up. And this is just an observation, not saying definitively one has anything to do with the other. But back in the 80s, when he started putting all the territories out of business, or at least, you know, weakening them and doing, you know, all the ruthless stuff that he was doing. As the stories go, Vince McMahon was known back then to show up at random at TV stations all over the country. If there was a territory, let's say, that operated and had TV in a local market, let's say in Boston, I'm just using that as an example, he would show up at the station in Boston with a briefcase full of money. And he would ask them to cancel the local wrestling show and replace it with his own WWF programming. That was partly how he was able to take over. Now, I say, again, he put them out of business. Truth be told, a lot of those territories would have gone belly up anyway. It was more like Vince sped up the process. But this is what he would do. So when Snuka went and mentioned the briefcase in his book, which I don't think anybody even knew about until Snuka opened his big fat mouth, you know, 3 years ago in his book and said that, I immediately thought of that story. Now, does that mean that Vince paid off the cops? No, I'm not saying that. Only one person for sure knows what was in that briefcase, and that's Vince McMahon. But the way this whole case was handled, it's mind-boggling to me that they never thought there was enough to even bring charges against Snuka. Maybe Snuka, look, they could have tried him, they could have put him on trial, and maybe he would have gotten off. Maybe the evidence really wasn't as strong as it needed to be, and he would have skated. Who knows? But to not even charge the guy? And we're first finding things out now in the last 2 years that the cops knew about for decades. They knew all about this stuff. Something happened here. Whether Vince was involved or not, I don't think Vince is in any kind of real jeopardy here. That's another question I've been getting. Is this the end of Vince McMahon? Is he going to go to jail? Is he going to have to, you know, sell his remaining stock in the company to Triple H and Stephanie? The answer is no. That's not going to happen. Vince is not going to jail. I don't think Vince is in any kind of real trouble here. It looks bad. I mean, it looks really bad for him, but he's not in any kind of real jeopardy here. At the very least, though, they probably should sit him down and ask him a few questions. And if this thing goes to trial, you know, maybe they will. But I know that one of the detectives in that original meeting with Snuka and Vince, who was part of the original investigation, and he was in the secret meeting, he's still there, and he's still working the case. So I won't hold my breath on them asking Vince McMahon any questions, because if there was something fishy going on, there's other people involved here who I think would have a vested interest in keeping that quiet. So again, I wouldn't expect them to even ask Vince any questions. I'm just waiting for all the apologists to try to make excuses for Snuka because, you know, come on, he's the Superfly and jumping off the cage onto Don Morocco and Roddy Piper and the coconut. Or yeah, you know, maybe he killed her, but it was an accident. He didn't mean to kill her, as if that makes it okay. I already saw some of that on like, Facebook. Well, he didn't mean to. Of course he's guilty, but he didn't mean to. Yeah, this isn't the same as accidentally killing somebody who jumps out in front of your car. Unless you were texting or speeding or drunk, accidents happen. Things like that, unfortunately, happen every day. This is different. If he killed her and was pretty violent with her, if you read the autopsy report, then he deserves to be punished. I don't care how old he is. I don't care what condition he's in. You know, there's a history of violence there. It shouldn't have taken 32 years, but better late than never. Better for it to happen when he's still alive and not after the fact. I mean, I have sympathy with the guy for one reason, and that's because of his cancer. I hate cancer. It sucks. I don't wish it on anybody. But that's where my sympathies start and stop with Jimmy Snuka. And if he's guilty, he should be punished. Now, WWE released a statement. They said they express their continued sympathy to the Argentino family for their loss. Ultimately, this legal matter will be decided by our judicial system. The next day, they suspended Snuka's Legends deal. They removed him from the Hall of Fame section on WWE.com, saying Jimmy Snuka's non-wrestling Legends contract has been suspended, and we are currently removing his images from our media platforms pending the outcome of this case. It was something they had to do. You can't take Hulk Hogan off the Hall of Fame page and erase him from history for using a racial slur and not do the same for a guy that's been charged with murder. You know, I got so many questions about the Hall of Fame right after the charge, like the same day that the charges were announced. The only thing that most people were interested in, what does this mean for the Hall of Fame? What does this mean for the website? That would have been at the bottom of my list of important things to talk about when it came to this story. There is no Hall of Fame to talk about. It's a web page. That's all it is. Why aren't people asking if they're going to ask Snuka to return his plaque? Or his ring, whichever it is. I think he got a plaque when he was inducted, but they may have given everybody since then rings. You know, I'm sure he still has his plaque. It's not like he's really out of the Hall of Fame. Just like Hogan. Hogan is not out of the Hall of Fame. I don't care what he says. I don't care what some reporter on ABC says who doesn't know anything from anything. He's not out of the Hall of Fame. I'll bet my ass that Hulk Hogan still has his Hall of Fame ring. You know, they took their names off the website. That's really all they did. I've also been getting a lot of questions about Tamina. What does this mean for her status with the company? Would they release her? Of course not. She didn't do anything wrong. Why would they release her? I can see them giving her some time off if this thing goes to trial. In fact, I expect that she is going to disappear for a while soon. But long term, I mean, even if Snuka is found guilty, it has no bearing on her employment. It says nothing to do with Tamina. So that's the update on Snuka. We'll find out more. It's going to be a while, I guess, before this really kind of plays itself out, that hearing, whenever that may be. I think it's going to get pushed back. And then if they can convince people that he is not fit to stand trial, if they buy into this bogus argument that he has dementia, he doesn't know where he is, and all this other nonsense, if they can get away with it, then maybe he won't stand trial. But that's kind of the update as of now. Maybe then if he gets off and he doesn't have to stand trial, maybe he can wheel himself around with OJ. They can go look for the killers together. So as eventful as Tuesday turned out to be, last Monday was even more interesting. And it actually had nothing to do with Raw that night, which was the opposite of interesting. First, Hulk Hogan had a sit-down interview that aired on Good Morning America. I think I mentioned last week it had been taped the Thursday before, and it aired on Monday morning. It was exactly what I said it was going to be. He begged for forgiveness, he cried, and whatever goodwill he could have built up by just owning up to what he said and apologizing for it and saying it was stupid of him to say it and that's not who he really is, that would have been enough. He couldn't help himself, and he kept talking and talking, and by the end, I couldn't believe a word out of his mouth. He claimed that he was at the lowest point in his life when he said those things on that tape. He was suicidal. I haven't read any of his books, so I don't know if he addresses this, but I do know that he has told the story, and I know this is in one of his books, that he almost committed suicide. This probably was about 5 or 6 years ago, but Layla Ali, who was his co-host at the time when they rebooted American Gladiators, happened to call him just at the right moment before he could pull the trigger. Now, here's the thing. American Gladiators, it didn't start airing. I had to look up the air date. It didn't start airing until January of 2008. I don't remember if the show aired live or not. My guess is that it didn't, so it's entirely possible that they had already taped a whole bunch of episodes in late 07 that didn't air until January. The suicide attempt that he talks about in public came in December of 2007, before American Gladiators started airing. But let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say that he's telling the truth. He had already met her, he was working with her, and she called him at exactly the right moment and saved his life. Now, he's claiming he was suicidal in 2006, because that's when the sex tape with him and Heather Klemm was filmed. That was the first thing that jumped out at me. He's never mentioned being suicidal at any other time in his life, only with the Layla Ali story. So that's new. He was asked flat out, are you a racist? He said, no, I'm not a racist. I never should have said what I said. It was wrong. I'm embarrassed by it. Okay, right there. Right there, if he would have stopped, it would have been perfect. I'm not a racist. What I said was wrong. It was stupid, and I'm embarrassed. Great. Perfect. But he kept on going. He said, I inherited things from my upbringing where I grew up in South Tampa. It was a rough neighborhood, very low income, and all my friends, we greeted each other saying that word, presumably the N-word. The word was thrown around like it was nothing, he said. So now we went from contrite and taking responsibility to, it was my neighborhood. Hulk Hogan, straight out of Compton. Quick, someone get me a mock-up of that. The reporter asked if it was fair to say that he inherited a racial bias. Hogan said, that's very fair. All of my white friends, all of my black friends, that's how we would greet each other in the morning. Good morning, so-and-so. He's so full of shit. He's so full of shit. We're supposed to believe that in 1963 or 1968, that all of Hulk Hogan's friends greeted one another in the morning with the N-word. He's full of shit. I don't believe that for a second. Why even say that? It is so unbelievable to me. Why would he even bother saying something like that? And the thing is, he doesn't have to do it. He could win people back and sound sincere, but he just can't help himself from sprinkling just a little bit of bullshit on everything. Bullshit is Hogan's favorite condiment. He uses it the way that people use barbecue sauce on their burger. Guess what? Not everything needs barbecue sauce. Burgers and ribs are not good enough for Hulk Hogan. He's got to smear that shit on his pancakes, too. Like, you know, people tell lies. Hogan takes it to another level. He's got a PhD in it, but everybody lies. Some people tell little white lies. How do I look today? Oh, you look great. But in your mind, you're like, God, she looks like shit. Some people tell big lies. He had the opportunity here to really take that first step in getting back in people's good graces, maybe even getting back in WWE's good graces. It is so obvious this guy is so desperate to get back in the good graces of Vince McMahon and WWE. The reporter even said at the end of the segment, Hogan would give his right arm to get back into wrestling. He wants it so badly. And he had an opportunity here to start back on that path. I would never tell one of my clients to do what he did in this interview. So, sure enough, guess what happened? One of the local TV stations in Tampa must have had their bullshit detectors going off too, because they went and tracked down some of Hogan's old friends and people that lived in the neighborhood that he grew up in. And this was the headline of the story. Hulk Hogan under fire after slamming neighborhood on national TV. So the story went from Hulk Hogan apologizes and moves on with his life to yet another unnecessary controversy of his own making. They interviewed one woman, Linda Bryant, who grew up with Hogan and said that wasn't the culture when Terry grew up here, another Linda fucking him over. There was a second neighbor who said there was a time this area was poor, but we didn't use that word. This guy's children grew up in the house right next to where Hogan lived, and he said, my daughter's not like that, my son's not like that. If you said it, then own it. How come the neighbor gets it, but Hogan doesn't? So, to wrap this whole thing up here, at the end, Hogan is literally begging for forgiveness. Oh gosh, please forgive me. Please forgive me, he says. I'm a nice guy. Hulk Hogan has been a nice guy to a lot of people, a lot of kids throughout his career, a lot of charity stuff, a lot of Make-A-Wish. But what he doesn't get, what he doesn't understand about why people were so upset about what he said, was the tone in which he said it. There's a difference in tone between using the N-word and saying fucking N-word. And that has nothing to do with these phantom friends that all greeted each other with the word when they were, what, 12? And he doesn't get that. He just wants this to go away as quickly as possible so things can go back to normal, and it doesn't work that way. Saying stuff like he said in this interview is not going to make it any easier for him to put this shit behind him. It's only going to make it worse. So then we have another sad sack, Bram. We found out that he will no longer be signing any new contracts with TNA. His real name is Thomas Latimer. He was arrested for domestic battery by strangulation and false imprisonment, both of which are felony offenses, after attacking his girlfriend last weekend. This was not Charlotte. The two of them are divorced. Cops were called. They saw signs of a struggle. They had been arguing. The girlfriend felt threatened. She retreated into her bedroom. Latimer followed her into the bedroom, shut the door, refused to let her leave, shoved her onto the bed, and held her down by her neck. And he admitted to what happened when the cops showed up to question him, and he was arrested and taken to jail. And that admission, I think, right there is key. He was released on Tuesday at $5,000 bond for the strangulation charge, $1,000 bond for the false imprisonment charge. TNA said they were suspending Latimer indefinitely while they worked to gather facts and obtain additional information related to the arrest. A real winner, this guy is. This is not the first time he has been arrested or violent. He was arrested for DUI once. He was cut from NXT after he was arrested for assaulting a police officer. On the list of things not to do in life, assaulting a cop is pretty high up there. That's what ended his run as part of the Ascension. He and Connor were the original team, and then he got fired, and they plugged Rick Victor, who had just been existing on NXT as I think mostly an enhancement guy, really. They plugged him into his spot. I mean, look, the guy is talented. I'm not going to deny that. I did a buy or sell segment on the podcast a few months ago, and I picked him over Brian Cage. You know, that's how much potential I thought he had. He's got an intensity about him that a lot of people don't have. Unfortunately, I guess he's a little too intense. So I have no idea what TNA is waiting for. You know, the fact that he admitted to what he did to cops should be enough for them to just cut ties with the guy. It's not like he's that big of a star to them that they must hold on. It's like, you know, Kurt Angle got arrested for the 10th time or something like that. I don't know what they're waiting for. But as of right now, he is suspended but not terminated from TNA. And as if all of that wasn't enough, we end with a shooting. Because why not? Outside the Performance Center last Monday in Orlando, thankfully nobody working there was hurt. No wrestlers were shot. The only person hurt was the suspect, who was shot, I believe, in the stomach. He was rushed into emergency surgery with life-threatening injuries. He's still alive, as far as anybody knows. The guy's a real whack job. I'm not even going to mention his name. He's 29 years old. He had been arrested multiple times before. The police there were well aware of who he was. He had vandalized the Performance Center before. He smeared his own urine and feces all over the walls outside. He was ordered to pay $5,000 for the damage that he did. He had threatened employees before at the Performance Center with bodily harm. He showed up there once with a chain, and the cops had to draw their guns on him. He was angry because they wouldn't hire him. Can't imagine why. he had an obsession with AJ Lee. Had all these things written about her on his Facebook page. He even posted a photo of his sneakers with AJ's name written on them. But I want to clear something up here. A lot of people seem to think that this incident had to do with AJ. Not true. He was there looking for Lita. And that comes from this week's Observer. She had been at the Performance Center every week doing Tough Enough-related stuff, but she wasn't there when this happened. And also, when the guy was arrested earlier in the month of August, the cops said they found a chair, they found binoculars, and a whiteboard in his car with the words, "Lita, I love you," scrawled on it. They said as they were taking him to jail, the guy kept asking them if they had seen Lita inside the building. He said he loved her, she's attractive. He kept laughing at himself and saying, "This is awesome." That part comes directly from an article on the WKMG TV website, clickorlando.com. I think some people are confusing his obsession with AJ over what happened here. Whatever you may hear elsewhere, that this had more to do with Lita than it did AJ. The guy is mentally ill. You know, I think that's pretty obvious. WWE had taken out a restraining order against him and tried to serve it to him a few weeks ago, but his mother wouldn't take it. He posted a video on YouTube of himself standing outside what appears to be Titan Tower in Stamford looking for a job. In the video, he says, "Yeah, what's the worst they can say? Probably get the hell off our property," would be my guess, and maybe that's what set him off. So he showed up again at the Performance Center last Monday, and WWE called the cops. Someone mentioned he had a knife when they phoned the cops, or might have a knife. I don't know that they recovered any knife from him. I haven't seen any mention of one. The cop showed up, he advanced toward them when they told him not to do so, and they fired one shot. I'll tell you what the scary thing is about this. If they don't put this guy in jail or commit him to a mental institution, what happens when he gets out? You know, I'd be nervous if I work at the Performance Center. If this guy is that obsessed, if, you know, there's no telling what he's capable of. You know, they could hire some cops to work off-duty as security. That's one of the articles said they had already been in discussions with the local police department there about doing just that before all of this happened. I mean, they could still do that. They should do that. But if they let this guy go, you know, realistically, there's only so much they can do. You can't have somebody standing there 24 hours a day. You know, and even if you do, that doesn't mean he wouldn't try something stupid. So just a very scary situation, and hopefully they will put him away, and he will get whatever help he needs. Monday Night Raw was, like I said earlier, probably the least interesting thing that happened last Monday. It was live from Tampa, Florida, hopefully not in the bad neighborhood that Hulk Hogan grew up in. So we'll leave the murders and the shootings and the strangulations, and we will talk about Sting. He was there to talk about how great Triple H is, and really not much else. He put Triple H over so much and made you want to see Triple H get the title shot at Night of Champions against Seth Rollins. And when you really stop and think about it, it would make more sense to see that, given that Triple H is the one who pins Sting at WrestleMania. And they're obviously building to a Triple H-Seth Rollins match at some point anyway. So Sting is effectively the setup guy for Triple H. He talked about what an honorable man Hunter is and the great respect he has for him and how Triple H was man enough to shake his hand when the match was over after he beat him at WrestleMania. Just the way he said that, I laughed. This guy beat my ass, and he was man enough to shake my hand when it was over. I guess instead of, like, spitting on me. And even though Triple H was the one who hit him in the head with a sledgehammer to get that win. So anyway, I know he's saying these things to drive a wedge. I think that's the story they're telling. He's trying to drive a wedge between Triple H and Seth Rollins. There was already heat on this show with Stephanie and Seth. Triple H wasn't there. But this just came off as so stupid. I think when people envision Sting eventually coming to WWE, I'm willing to bet this is not what they had in mind. Not necessarily that they didn't think something like this might happen, but this is not what people wanted to see from a Sting run in WWE. He vowed to win the title that has always eluded him, the WWE Championship, and he left. Backstage, Rollins wanted to know where his statue was, and Stephanie told him, "Go ask Sting." Sting wasn't supposed to be on Raw tomorrow night. Apparently plans have changed. He will be on the show. I don't know doing what, but maybe he has more to say about his great admiration for Triple H. Rusev and Ziggler had a SummerSlam rematch. Ziggler had him beat after the zigzag. Summer Rae ran in for the DQ. Lana went after her. They had a catfight. Had to be pulled apart. We got to see more of Lana here in this segment than we have maybe ever before. It was quite great. Lana and Dolph made out. Rusev had a meltdown. I'm telling you people, double turn. I've been saying this for how many months now? It's what I would do. I even joked on Twitter they could have Summer Rae start kicking the shit out of Rusev after he loses in the final match of the feud, and then Lana makes the emotional save and she reunites with Rusev, this time as babyface. It's the WrestleMania 7 finish. But then again, they couldn't possibly pull it off as well as Savage and Liz, so I don't know that recreating that finish is maybe the best idea, since if you can't do something better than the original, then why bother doing it at all? And plus, you know, Savage and Liz were together for so many years. I mean, back then, these stories really, you know, they were built up over a long period of time. I mean, Rusev and Lana were together for a while, but not as long as Savage and Liz. But I was only half-joking when I said that. I mean, I do think they should do a double turn at the end of all this. Put Summer with Dolph as a heel combo. Reunite Lana with Rusev, which I think is going to be happening no matter what, whether they're heels or babyfaces. But Ziggler's just sort of stagnant, you know, as a face. Not, you know, people like him, but he's not really going anywhere, and he's not going to be in title contention anytime soon. So when the feud with Rusev is played out, you know, what do you do with him? Summer has no chemistry with Rusev. Lana has even less chemistry with Dolph. Just swap them. Backstage, Lana left Ziggler on his own so he can go take a shower. And as Renee Young was talking, she's standing there looking in the camera, previewing some matches that are going to be taking place, which was odd because they never do that. Sure enough, behind her, we could see Summer Rae sneaking into Dolph Ziggler's dressing room. We had this beat-the-clock challenge with Team PCB. Whoever could win their match the fastest would get the title shot at Nikki Bella at Night of Champions. Nikki came out, unveiled her little countdown clock to breaking AJ's record as the longest reigning Divas champion of all time. When the clock strikes midnight on Tuesday, September 15th, she will have the record. Of course, Night of Champions is not until September 20th. So it looked as though they were going to hand her the record on a platter, which would have been a huge mistake. But on SmackDown, Charlotte, who won the Beat the Clock challenge, said that she had petitioned the authority to get her title shot on Raw before Night of Champions, which would be the 14th, which makes sense, because why wouldn't you build drama around whether or not Nikki will set the record? And why introduce the countdown clock unless you were going to play off it in some way? So it's not official yet, but that match will take place on Raw instead. The more I think about it, if they're going to do the countdown clock gimmick, and Nikki's a heel, at least I think she is. For this week, she is. Then she should lose. Charlotte wins the title. Nikki falls one day short of the record. I know people say, oh, she's with John Cena. Of course, what a foolish thing to say. I think there's a very good chance that she'll fall one day short. I don't think, by any means, it's a foregone conclusion that she's going to break the record. I think there's a very good chance she doesn't. And with the clock and everything else, you know, you should book the babyface to foil the heel at the last minute. I mean, it is tempting if they wanted to split up Team PCB, which has been the rumor, to have Paige turn heel by costing Charlotte the match. I mean, she would get super heat. If Charlotte's got the match won and the record is about to fall and Paige costs her the match, she would get a ton of heat for it. The way this Beat the Clock stuff ended, you know, the way they focused on how sad Paige was, they're clearly setting something up. As far as the actual Beat the Clock matches on this show, they were nothing matches. I hate the Beat the Clock concept to begin with. They need to bury it right next to that stupid scramble match that thankfully they stopped doing years ago. Becky Lynch beat Alicia Fox in 3 minutes and 21 seconds. Charlotte then beat Brie Bella in 1 minute 40. This match set the Divas Revolution back about 50 years. It was horrendous. Brie tried to run away from Charlotte. Charlotte chased after her. It didn't look particularly good. The fans didn't care. This sucked. But part of it was by design. You know, it was designed to be a bunch of short matches with people trying to stall out the clock and chase after each other. You know, that works, for example, in the all-night-long match that Prince Puma and Johnny Mundo had on Lucha Underground. But that was also a 60-minute Iron Man match. So there were so many different stories being told, and the action was so great, and they were out there for so long, and they had you hooked, that Mundo trying to run out the clock in the last few minutes actually made sense, and him running away, and he was going to win. Like, in a situation like that, it's perfect. Like, it heightens the drama and everything else. There is no drama here. This just sucks when you have a bunch of women who are just, you know, the bell rings, and from the moment the bell rings, all it is a relay race around the ring. You know, and they're trying to tell us every week, Divas Revolution, Divas Revolution. I didn't see any evidence of that on this show. This was just bad TV. And it's, when the fans don't even react, when they just kind of sit there, that's the worst kind of reaction that you can get. So these women were doomed. It's not their fault. They were doomed from, you know, the opening bell, because these matches weren't supposed to go more than a minute or two. And what can you really do in a minute or two? I mean, let's be honest here. They put Sasha Banks out there with Paige, which only went until the time expired, which was 1 minute and 40 seconds. Paige could not beat that time, so Charlotte won. At least they didn't job out Sasha in under 90 seconds, which was my fear. But the idea of even having Sasha Banks in a match on Raw where she's an afterthought and it only goes a minute 40 is just such a waste of what they have with her. She never should have even been involved in this nonsense. This right here is why I pitched doing a triple threat match with the members of PCB in my column that I did for TJR Wrestling last week. And then they made the announcement of the Beat the Clock stuff, like, after I did the column. They took a variation of the idea that I had pitched, but they wanted to be cute with it. So instead of giving them 10 or 15 minutes to go out there in a triple threat and maybe putting together a really good match, you know, that the crowd might care about, they took three women who were all really good workers and they put them in three shorter nothing matches that nobody gave a shit about. So if they are teasing a Paige heel turn, you could have done the exact same thing after the three-way and showed Paige being all sad that she didn't win, I'm just saying. We had a Ryback interview outside his dressing room. Apparently the mid-carders in WWE all have their own dressing rooms now. As he was talking, we saw Summer Rae run screaming out of Ziggler's dressing room, and then he emerged wearing nothing but a towel. I saw far too much of Dolph Ziggler here. Later, he tried to explain to Lana what happened, but she wouldn't have any of it. All she wanted to know is, did she see you naked? And he said she did, but it was only like 2 seconds max. And Lana was pissed and walked off. Why would she be pissed at Dolph and not Summer? Unless they go with my idea and we end up finding out that it was more than 2 seconds and Dolph actually liked it. And this was the beginning of the turn. Aha, see? That would make sense. Later, Summer Rae did this ridiculous interview where she said she only wanted to smooth things over with Dolph, but Dolph tried to seduce her. Basically, she was sexually harassed. You see? Men can be sexually harassed too, and women lie about it. I am shocked that we have a storyline like this on a show written predominantly, if not completely, by men. Gotta give props to Ryback and Big Show. They had a match for the Intercontinental title that wasn't bad. It actually turned into a pretty good match. Big Show is nuts, taking some of the bumps that he does at his age, at that size. Miz was on commentary. He distracted Big Show, which allowed Ryback to get the shell shock for the pin. In the middle of the match, Big Show got pissed off at all the please retire chants. He grabbed the mic. He told the fans to find somebody to retire me. He may get his wish at Madison Square Garden October 3rd. They announced that it will be Big Show wrestling Brock Lesnar. That could spell the end of poor Big Show. Kevin Owens beat Cesaro for the second straight time on this show as well, and based on his promo from SmackDown, it looks like he may be going after the Intercontinental title next, which I'm okay with. I'm okay with that. He and Ryback had a little exchange. I don't know how many of you picked up on it. The week before, they had an 8-man tag, and they got in the ring together at one point, and it looked like they were just throwing down with one another. They were throwing bombs. I mean, for real, it looked like a fight. I'd be fine with them just punching the shit out of each other. Braun Strowman had his first singles match on TV as a member of the Wyatt family. He wrestled Dean Ambrose, tossed him around like a rag doll. He shoved Roman Reigns on the outside, which caused Roman to attack him for the DQ. They did the old Hogan Zeus spot where Strowman had Reigns in his head and neck choke finish thing, whatever. Ambrose whacked him in the back with a chair. He no-sold the chair shot, dropped Reigns, slowly did the little head turn, staring down Ambrose. I still remember that spot like it was yesterday. I think it may have been after a Macho Man Brutus Beefcake match on Saturday night's main event, I think, in the build-up to their tag team match at SummerSlam 89. I thought that Strowman did just fine. I expected worse. I think he's getting a little too much hate from some of what I've seen online. He exceeded my expectations, which were very low to begin with. I mean, I knew how inexperienced he was and didn't quite know what to expect. But he didn't embarrass himself out there. He's been booked exactly like a Zeus or a Giant Gonzalez back in the day. This unstoppable heel monster. The one problem I have with him is that head and neck choke. He's got to come up with a different move. It just looks completely silly. The Dudley Boys had their first match together on Raw in over a decade. Based on the crowd reaction here, you would never know that. Tampa was terrible. I'm sorry to all the Tampa folks, but it's true. They beat the New Day in a non-title match, so between that and pinning the primetime players on SmackDown this week, it looks like they will be getting the next title shot at Night of Champions. Seth Rollins came out for nap time. I mean a promo. He said that he used to have respect for Sting, but now he realizes that Sting was the reason why WCW folded. Now, wait just a minute. I could have sworn they said that Triple H was the reason WCW folded. I don't know what to believe anymore. Stephanie McMahon came out, told Seth that he needs to stop talking crap about her husband. At this point, I tweeted about how refreshing it was to keep John Cena off the show this week. I said it's actually okay to keep him off the show every now and then. It makes him a little more tolerable that way. And then I heard the trumpets. And I felt like a fool. John Cena came out. He reminded Seth Rollins that every title will be defended at Night of Champions and said that he was cashing in his rematch clause for a U.S. title match at the pay-per-view, which means two title defenses for Rollins, which is exactly what I said last week they were probably going to do. Cena left. He posed on stage with Sting, who walked out, and that ended what really was not a very good show. But they can't all be winners.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
We have the start of the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic on NXT this week, which will culminate at the next TakeOver special October 7th. I'm going to run through the brackets here. It's a 16-team tournament. Bracket A has Kaz and Enzo against Angelo Dawkins and Sawyer Fulton, and Finn Balor and Samoa Joe against the Lucha Dragons. Bracket B has Blake and Murphy against the Vaudevillains, and Tucker Knight and Elias Sampson against Scott Dawson and Dash Wilder. Bracket C has the Hype Brothers against Marcus Louis and Alexander Wolf, and Jason Jordan and Chad Gable against Neville and Solomon Crowe, which Jordan and Gable won. And Bracket D has Rhino and Baron Corbin, who beat the Ascension this week. And next week, it's Tyler Breeze and Bull Dempsey against Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa. That was quite the surprise to see the two of them in William Regal's office this week. Gargano wrestles for Evolve, which is interesting, given the talk of Gabe Sapolsky, who runs Evolve, being in discussions with WWE about some kind of working agreement with each other. He was backstage for TakeOver and SummerSlam. They invited him out. Gargano actually wrestled on a Global Force wrestling show about 2 months ago. Ciampa was once under a WWE developmental deal. He spent some time in OVW, but got cut. He wrestled in ROH, and now he is back with WWE, at least for 1 week. I don't know if this is a long-term deal or not. It really hit me watching this, though. And then right after this, they had an Apollo Crews match that Triple H's Indie Invasion is in full effect. We are seeing it right before our very eyes. There's chatter that WWE is interested in Jay Lethal, who holds the ROH World and TV titles right now. He really should have been in WWE a long time ago. They were idiots for not picking him up. Now he's having success as a headliner somewhere else, and suddenly he's on their radar. And I would imagine ROH has him locked up, though, for a while. The Ascension made their return to Full Sail, losing to Corbin and Rhino in the Dusty Rhodes Classic. The Ascension got welcome back chants. They were as over as I've ever seen them. They were over as babyfaces here. They look so amped up to be back on NXT. And I mean, really, can you blame them? Although on SmackDown, I guess they finally did something with these guys. They put them with Stardust as part of this new group called Cosmic Wasteland. This is how I imagine the creative meeting went when they came up with that. Hey, we're not doing anything with these two guys. Anybody got any ideas? Yeah, I know. Stardust wears face paint. So do they. let's make them a group. Pretty much the same way those meetings work when they have three black guys they have no idea how to use. I know. Let's make them a group. Alexa Bliss pinned Blue Pants with the Sparkle Splash. For all you Blue Pants fans out there, there is a YouTube series called The Geek Cave. A few weeks back, they dedicated an episode to a tour of her apartment. I can confirm she is, in fact, a giant nerd, and I think I love her even more for it. So check that out if that's your thing. Apollo Crews beat Martin Stone. Gorilla Press Slam followed up with a standing moonsault for the pin. Second black WWE champion after The Rock. This guy's going to be it. I'm calling it right now. And I'll watch. Some people will get all pissy I said that about The Rock, but, you know. Facts are facts. Just because WWE doesn't dwell on the fact that Rock was black does not make it any less true. You can't say that Obama is the first black president and Rock wasn't the first black WWE champion. Apollo Crews is, he's going to be the next one. Vince is going to love this guy when they bring him up. Jason Jordan and Chad Gable cut a promo backstage on their opponents in the Dusty Rhodes Classic, Neville and Solomon Crowe. I don't remember anything else they said, but can I just say I love Chad Gable? He even sounds like Kurt Angle when he speaks. He sounds like Kurt when Kurt first came to WWE. I mean, I'm listening to this guy talk, and I'm just waiting for him to say, "You're Olympic hero." I mean, that's how eerie it is. Eva Marie had a match against Billie Kay. Oh boy. That botch. That was a bad one. Billie had Eva pinned after a suplex. Eva was supposed to kick out. She forgot to kick out. Unlike the Emma match in Brooklyn where the ref did what they're trained to do, which is call it like a shoot, the difference here is that Eva is undefeated since coming back and they don't want to beat her. So the ref held up the count and it looked terrible. The crowd shit all over her after this. The boos just rained down upon this woman for the next, 60 seconds until the match ended with her using the sliced bread for the win. She wasn't doing that badly until the botch, and then it just killed the whole match and just fell apart. And they want to put the title on her. I think, and I even said that too. And now these reports are out saying that the plan is maybe for Bayley to wrestle Dana Brooke. And then after Dana Brooke, she would go up against Eva Marie, which I guess basically confirms that they're not going to give Emma a title shot, even though she won that four-way. So even her accidental win can't get her an accidental title shot. But I said, they probably want to keep her undefeated. I don't think she's going to lose a single match until she beats Bayley, and she will, to win that championship. And I think that's a big mistake. Hopefully, plans change a lot in WWE, so if this thing is still a few months away from happening, there's always a chance that plans could change. But, yeah, I don't like that plan at all. Jordan and Gable in the main event against Neville and Crowe. Real good match. Jordan and Gable are a great tag team. Gable is so much fun to watch when he tags in, does all the amateur stuff. They did their finish on Crowe where Jordan throws him up into the air. Gable catches him on the way down with a bridging back suplex for the win. It surprised me that they would beat Neville in the first round, but I was not unhappy with the result. I'm sure Solomon Crowe probably wasn't too thrilled. They have to be turning him heel with all these losses. They just have to. I mean, the guy is going nowhere fast. They're playing up even on commentary how much of a loser he is and that he hasn't been very successful of late. It's got to be leading somewhere. A heel turn, and then a hot winning streak is about the only thing that might rehab him at this point. So for his sake, I hope that's what they do, because otherwise it ain't looking too good. All right, let's play a little Tuesday morning wrestling here, and then we'll get to ROH and your questions. This is a song about Ric Flair.
Wrestling skills.
four of these guys get hate mail for calling Arn Anderson average. I assume that was taken from his own retirement speech on Nitro, where he himself said that he had average size, average speed, and average ability. He doesn't give himself enough credit. Arn Anderson was great. One of the coolest memories I have of the last four WrestleManias I've been to is interviewing him and Tully and just shooting the shit with him after we were done. It was great. Ring of Honor on Destination America. At least they are still on Destination America. TNA may not have that luxury in a few more weeks. Still nothing new on that front. But the show this week opened with Adam Page and Colby Carino in his corner taking on Jay Briscoe. Wasn't a very long match at all. There was a DQ, and Mark Briscoe ran in to make the save when they were beating the hell out of Jay with chairs in the ring. In fact, Adam Page did his little backwards pile driver move onto a pile of chairs, and that's when Mark ran out. He was throwing chairs like a crazy man. We had, after the break, an update on the Silas Young-Dalton Castle storyline. Now, the last we heard, you know, Dalton Castle had beaten Silas Young, and Silas said, "Listen, I want one more match. If I beat you, I get your boys, and I'm going to make men out of them." So this was a backstage interview with Dalton and his boys. Haven't seen too many Dalton Castle promos myself in ROH, so this was unique, a little over the top, but I still like the guy. He added another very interesting stipulation to their next match, and that is that if he wins, if Dalton Castle wins, Silas Young has to become one of his boys. And that makes things a lot more interesting, and now I am pulling for a Dalton Castle win. I think that's what ends up happening anyway. I think Castle probably wins. I think the idea of Silas Young having to go around being one of his boys actually has a lot of potential to be entertaining. Probably a lot more than the other way around. We had Cedric Alexander with Veda Scott taking on Caprice Coleman. Cedric tried to back out of the match because Caprice was not really a relevant opponent for him, but then Caprice had some words on the mic that were not kind to Veda, and that got under Cedric's skin, so they had a match. Pretty good match, too. Moose came out, and he ended up costing Cedric the win via distraction, and then he actually whacked him in the head with the wrench, the same wrench that Cedric had used to beat Moose before. So he kind of turned the tables on him there. This was a good match. I like Cedric Alexander. I think there's something there with him. Then we had my favorite feud in ROH, Brutal Bob and Cheeseburger. Cheeseburger, by the way, is Chris Jericho's new favorite wrestler. So says Jericho on Twitter this week. So they had a match. If you remember, the last match they had ended with Brutal Bob putting Cheeseburger with a side suplex through a table on the outside. Both of them were killed dead. There was no decisive winner. This time there was a decisive winner. Brutal Bob had set a table up outside the ring. He was trying to put Cheeseburger through it again with a side suplex, but Cheeseburger escaped. He ended up knocking Brutal Bob off the apron, who took a flat back bump through the table. And Cheeseburger was just laying dead in the ring. The referee was counting. He got to 10, and then he kept counting, and for a brief moment there, I forgot that it's a 20 count in Ring of Honor. But by 15, the whole crowd was counting along, and you haven't seen a reaction to a count-out win this big since Lex Luger beat Yokozuna at SummerSlam. And at least Cheeseburger didn't come out of this looking like a complete fool. And the main event was for the television title. Jay Lethal, who, of course, is also the ROH World Champion, defending against Hanson, one half of War Machine. They had a long match, really good. I think I've spoken positive before about Hanson when his partner, Roe, had that motorcycle wreck and he was out for months with an injury. You know, Hanson did the singles thing for a while, and I hadn't seen too much of him, but I was very impressed by what I saw. He's a big dude, and some of the things he's able to do is pretty impressive. So I think the two of them had a really, really good match. Lethal got the win. It took two lethal injections in the end. He hit the first one, and Hanson was dazed, but he popped back up, gave him a second one, and got the pin. Clean win for the champion, the way it should be. And then after the match, we ended up having Roderick Strong came down to the ring, and Lethal bailed. Actually, let me back up a little bit here, because we had Bobby Fish was doing commentary at ringside for the match. Bobby Fish and Kyle O'Reilly both with matches against Jay Lethal upcoming. And so the two of them were kind of in a little bit of a stare down with Lethal. Lethal wasn't backing off. And that's when Roddy came out. He and Lethal are going to have a rematch, I believe, on TV next week, in fact, for the ROH World title. That's coming up. So a good episode. Yeah, the ROH shows, they just passed. They passed so quickly, and I still feel like we're missing some stuff. It may just be this week in ROH. That may be the only thing that we're missing. Some of you who do watch the Sinclair affiliate feed of the show got back in touch with me and told me after I asked about this last week that there really isn't much cut from the show other than the This Week in ROH segments. Too bad they don't have that. To me, that kind of reminds me of the old Event Center updates we used to get on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge. But, yeah, the show just passes by like that. It's very easy to watch. Let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. I'm going to try to get through a whole bunch of your questions here. We'll start with Bruno from Miami, because this is actually relevant. This is something else I wanted to talk about. In honor of this past week being the 20th anniversary of the debut of WCW Monday Nitro, which was a bigger deal, Lex Luger showing up on Nitro or X-Pac showing up on Raw? Well, Luger was a much bigger star, and having a WWF guy show up as a surprise on Nitro, I mean, that was a big deal at the time, very big deal. I mean, that was exactly the kind of thing WCW needed to do to get people's attention. So when you think of the first Nitro, the first shot, right? They even talk about this, I think, on the Monday Night War stuff. The first shot that was fired wasn't even really so much the creation of Nitro. It was Lex Luger walking out at the Mall of America. That was a big moment, much bigger than X-Pac walking out on Raw. Which was big because X-Pac showing up on Raw was the first bigger WCW name to defect back to WWF. And that started the whole... Well, it didn't start it, but that was part of the momentum shift that took place in 98. So that was a big deal, but not as big as Luger showing up on the first Nitro. Yeah, and again, I'm glad you brought that up because it was 20 years ago this past week that Nitro debuted and started the Monday Night War. I can't believe it's been that long. With, I was more of a WWF guy back then, but I flipped between the shows like everybody else did. Now you got, DVR and streaming sites. The younger fans today will never understand. The struggle was real back then. I asked you guys on Twitter to name your favorite Nitro moment, and a lot of you mentioned one that does not get a whole lot of love because I just think it's kind of glossed over, but it deserves all the love it gets and more. Which is when DDP dressed up as La Parca for a match against Randy Savage and he beat him with the diamond cutter. And the crowd, once he ripped the mask off, just went nuts for it. It was just one of those great moments. It was a genuine surprise that nobody saw coming. They probably should have, given that I would say DDP probably had, I don't want to say a foot, but he probably had a good 5 or 6 inches on La Parca. But it was a big surprise. I mean, kind of like the Dudleys coming out on Raw a few weeks ago. You know, the place went crazy. Nobody saw it coming. How many times can you honestly say these days, with the internet and social media, we actually get a genuine surprise where, no one is rumored to be on the show. They just show up and people go nuts. Doesn't happen very often. So I think that was one of the best Nitro moments. Luger racking Hogan to win the WCW title was another one that a lot of people didn't expect. Especially, they did that match 6 days before the pay-per-view. I think he lost the title right back to Hogan, but it was still just a great moment. And the whole roster comes out and they're celebrating with Luger. It was like a pay-per-view main event finish where they had, vanquished the NWO. The night they had all the fake Stings walk down to the ring, and the NWO was just beating them all up until Buff Bagwell took a shot at one of them, and the guy just stood there, and he took off the Sting mask to reveal that it was the real Sting, and then he gave him a Scorpion Death Drop. I mean, there's a lot of great, memorable Nitro moments before they ran that show into the ground, but if there's one that I would recommend you go check out, go find Goldberg and Raven on Nitro for the U.S. title. Raven is pummeling him in the corner. Raven hits the ropes, and when he comes off, Goldberg catches him with a spear. You have never seen a crowd jump to their feet, leap to their feet in unison all at once the way that these people did. This one spot got one of the biggest reactions I've ever seen. I'm not even exaggerating it. I mean, go find it on YouTube. From that point of the spear to the end of the match, it was like one long sustained pop until Goldberg pinned him and won the title. That is still to this day the best spear that I've ever seen, just in terms of the spear itself and the reaction and everything that goes with it. It was awesome. I mean, I would put Goldberg spearing Nunzio in the Royal Rumble, maybe right behind that one. I don't even know how Nunzio was still alive after that spear. But anyway, I do miss Nitro. I miss the competition. I think that's really what I miss about it more than anything else. Ben from Iowa. Daniel Bryan had a concussion and later saw a neurologist, the same one that worked the Super Bowl, who cleared him. But for whatever reason, WWE will not clear him to get back in the ring. If this was John Cena in the same situation, he suffered a concussion, had to sit out for a while, went to see his own doctor, and they cleared him, would WWE be holding him out, or would they instantly put him back into action? See, the big difference is that Bryan, by his own admission, has a very long history of concussions. I don't even think he knows exactly how many concussions he's had, but it's in the double digits. I'm sure Cena has had some concussions as well, but not as many as Bryan. That's what has WWE so hesitant to put him back in the ring. If it were Cena, you know, with his own medical history, he'd be back in action by now. And if Cena had 15 or 20 concussions in his past and suffered another bad one like Bryan did, I think they would have him on TV doing stuff, but not wrestling. They don't mess around with the concussion stuff anymore. I don't think they would treat him any differently than they would with Bryan, other than they would want Cena on TV doing stuff and being the face of the company still. You know, Bryan just, he's not as important as John Cena is to them, you know? There's a pecking order, and, you know, Cena and Lesnar are at the top, and Bryan is, you know, a couple of notches below. Nick from Germany, what is your opinion of the PWI 500 ranking for 2015? In my opinion, besides Rollins being number one, the list is complete garbage. Especially Roman Reigns getting a higher ranking than guys like Nakamura, Lethal, Tanahashi, Okada, Owen, Cesaro, and Lesnar. I'm just shocked that people still take that stuff seriously. You know, I mean, the PWI 500 hasn't been relevant in years. If you're on the list, it's a big deal. I get it. If I were a wrestler and I was, you know, number 74 on the PWI 500, it would be pretty cool. But I mean, come on. Come on. It's like those top 50 lists that WWE.com puts out every now and then, and people get all bent out of shape about it. They do it to get people talking. That's all it is. I don't take any of that stuff seriously. Andrews from Brazil wants to know my thoughts on WWE doing a G1 Climax-style tournament, which is basically, it's a round robin where everybody wrestles each other, with the finals taking place at SummerSlam, or maybe the winner gets a WWE title match at SummerSlam, like the G1 winner in New Japan gets the title shot at Wrestle Kingdom. He says, just the thought of Kofi Kingston beating John Cena clean in the early part of the tournament makes the idea interesting. Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. Yeah, it's like the King of the Ring idea that I've pitched before. You know, if they had any sense, they would do a King of the Ring tournament each year with the winner getting a title shot at SummerSlam. That way everything matters. You know, there are no throwaway shows. One has a direct impact on the next. That's how you get people to care about those shows that are not named WrestleMania or Royal Rumble. You know, like making War Games, the new annual Survivor Series tradition. How many years ago did I first pitch that idea on the podcast? I'm doing episode 400 next week, so it was probably, what, episode 50 or something like that? A long frickin' time ago. And I don't want to hear that by them having two rings, they're giving up ringside seats, which means they're not making as much money. Let me tell you something. WWE may not be as hot as they were during the Attitude Era when they were selling out buildings left and right, okay, week in and week out. But you try to buy tickets to a big show these days, especially if it's in a major market, and take a look at the ticket prices they're charging. It is ridiculous. And people buy them. It's not like they're jacking up the prices and people aren't buying them. They are. Now, granted, half are probably scalpers who put them right up on StubHub, but there are people buying them at those prices. All they need to do is, if they have to sacrifice some extra ringside seats to accommodate two rings, is jack up the cost of the ringside seats, and believe me, they'll make that money up. You can't tell me that if they did the show in a market like New York or L.A. or Chicago, that they wouldn't sell those seats out right away, even with the jacked up prices. But to go back to the round robin idea that Andrews mentioned, I love it, but they'd fuck it up somehow. You know, the G1 can be confusing to some people, even though it's really not. Can you imagine WWE trying to explain the rules of their own G1 to its fans? They have JBL using flashcards on TV trying to explain to us the difference between $54.99 and $9.99, like we're all brain dead. They have Michael Cole walking us through a video demonstration of how to install an app on our phone. If you own a smartphone and don't know how to install an app, your phone is smarter than you are. Now picture Beavis and Butthead over there trying to explain how this tournament works. It would actually be very entertaining. If for no other reason, just to see how they explain this on TV to their fans, I would love to see them try. Drew says, I was just watching the click stuff on the network and it made me wonder which Scott Hall gimmick was more over with the fans, Razor Ramon or Hall as himself in the Outsiders Invasion? I originally thought Razor, but toward the end of his WWF run, it looked like the character started losing some steam. That's a good question. I was a big Razor Ramon fan, and I think them losing Razor Ramon was a bigger deal than them losing Diesel in 96. To them, I think that's probably how they felt. I mean, I really do. I think the Diesel character was a main eventer more than Razor Ramon ever was. And there was actually a lot of potential with that new tweener Diesel gimmick they were doing at the end of 95, early 96, that I feel like they didn't fully exploit because they knew, I think they found out in February, he told Vince that he was leaving. But I think the loss of Razor was a much bigger blow to them. And, you know, Scott Hall and WCW, you can't say that Razor was bigger than Scott Hall because Scott Hall was... he was a headline guy in WCW, you know. He was one of the linchpins of that whole invasion angle, which is one of the most successful wrestling angles of all time. And as himself, as part of the Outsiders, he was, I don't want to say 10 times bigger, but he was a much bigger deal than Razor Ramon ever was. And you're right, you know, toward the end of Razor's run, even before they knew he was on the outs, I mean, look what they had him doing. You know, he was feuding with the 1-2-3 kid. He was not doing anything... you know, that you would consider to be main event level stuff. He was still on his fourth Intercontinental title he won. He wasn't even sniffing the WWF title. He wasn't doing anything with guys like Bret Hart or The Undertaker or anything like that. So I would have to go with Scott Hall. I mean, if you know, the question is which gimmick was more over with the fans. Like I said, Razor was over. He was very popular, but you know, the NWO was kind of like this cool faction. Everybody, they were the heels, but everybody loved them. Hall was doing his whole survey thing that he still does to this day. I don't think you can say that Razor Ramon was more over with the fans than Scott Hall was. I just don't think that's true. So I'd probably just go with Scott Hall as himself. Mike from Milwaukee, could you have gotten behind a Cinderella story that involved Maven winning the 2002 Royal Rumble and headlining WrestleMania 18? Absolutely not. Ross from Indianapolis, I wanted to know if you could give me some insight on the push or lack thereof for Haku / Meng. He was a tag team champion and king in WWF, but with all the stories of him being such a badass, it seems like it would have been perfect for him to have a monster heel run. Also, do you think if he had the same reputation and wrestled now, he would get a big singles push? You know, about the WWF run, I don't know. I would assume he didn't get the monster push because he wasn't as big as the monsters were supposed to be back then. You know, Andre and Stud and Kamala and Earthquake. These were big, you know, in some cases, not just big guys, but in some cases, big fat guys. And they built them up as this big threat because they were so much bigger than Hulk Hogan, right? How is Hulk Hogan, as big as he is, going to be able to body slam this 450-pound guy? Or if it was Kamala, this 360-pound guy or whatever. And Haku was not as big as those guys were. And also, when he first came in, he was doing the tag team thing. Maybe that had something to do with it. I honestly don't know, but that would be the best guess that I could venture. But if he was around today as Haku, like he was back in his WWF run. I'm not thinking Mang with the big afro in WCW. But if he was around as Haku today like he was back then in WWF, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no reason to think that he couldn't get the Umaga push or the Rusev push with a mouthpiece. You know, Umaga had Estrada, Rusev had Lana. Haku's not really a good promo, so they would have to put somebody with him. You know, back then he had Bobby Heenan. Unfortunately, the closest thing to a Bobby Heenan we have today is a Paul Heyman. And Heyman has managed some other guys, not with a whole lot of success, which is not entirely his fault. A big part of that is the booking. It's not like Heyman had the freedom to book his own storylines. That's why I kind of laugh when people say, oh, you know, Heyman guy, yeah, look what happened with Ryback. Look what happened with Curtis Axel. As though they had, you know, Heyman writing the storylines at the time. Like, you know, I mean, give me a break. But it's pretty obvious to me they just want to keep Heyman with Brock. And that's fine. I wouldn't want to do anything to break up that group. They're an awesome combo. But other than a guy like Heyman, I don't know who you would put with him. You know, that could really be as good as Bobby. There really is nobody as good as Bobby Heenan. Even Heyman. I mean, Heenan was the man. So if you could find somebody like that and put him with Haku, sure. Sure, like I said, if they did it with Umaga and they did it with Rusev, I mean that would have been the push that he would have gotten if he were to come along today. I just can't picture Haku being part of the current roster, you know, with a Twitter and an Instagram. It just seems wrong to me. Jota from Portugal has a buy or sell on who is more ruthless, Vince McMahon in the 80s or Eric Bischoff in the 90s. I'm going to buy on Vince and sell on Eric. Not even a question. The difference is that Bischoff wanted to put Vince McMahon out of business, but the only one he ever put out of business or had a hand in putting out of business was himself. I mean, I can't lay the demise of WCW all at his feet. That's not fair. But he definitely had a hand in it. Vince played a major role in those territories dying off as quickly as they did. I talked earlier in the podcast about the briefcases of money going to the affiliates, paying them to replace the local tapes with WWF tapes. He created the Survivor Series the same night as Starcade and told all the cable companies if they carried Starcade over his show, they wouldn't be allowed to air WWF shows anymore. He created the Royal Rumble as a free TV special to air the same night as an NWA pay-per-view. These are the kind of things that were going on back then. Bischoff signed away a lot of Vince's guys, but they were already past their expiration date to Vince. That's why he wasn't pushing them so hard anymore. That's why Randy Savage left. He wanted to wrestle, and Vince was like, no, you're going to be an announcer because we have the new generation, and they were focusing on Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Owen and the 1-2-3 Kid and Razor and all these other people. So, yeah, I mean, Bischoff signed a lot of those top names away and proved Vince wrong. There was still a lot of value left in guys like Hogan and Savage. I don't know if I would call that ruthless. I would call it smart on Bischoff's part. And look, if Vince wanted to keep them, he could have. So, yeah, I mean, Eric made them an offer. He took them away from him, but Vince could have kept them if he really wanted to. He just would have had to make it worth their while. He didn't have the money to spend. I don't know that I would call that ruthless. Bischoff would go on TV. He would give out the Raw spoilers before they aired. Again, I don't know if that's ruthless so much as that's just him being a dick. I used to get so pissed off at him for doing that. But Vince was one of the most ruthless guys that there were. I mean, not the only one, but he's certainly the one that had the most success. James has a good buy or sell. When Brock Lesnar debuted, he was the ultimate wrestler, combining freakish strength, agility, and technical ability. Brock could unleash any number of wrestling takedowns or suplexes as easily as he could a shooting star press. Well, except for one night. He destroyed the roster and became the youngest world title holder in WWE history at the time. The current incarnation of Brock Lesnar is UFC battle-tested, and obviously older but no less athletic, although he now limits his movesets to repeating the same two or three moves over and over again. Brock is currently the most over guy in the company and booked as near invincible. Buy or sell, Brock Lesnar from 2002 or current Brock Lesnar? I love them both. I hate to choose. I loved Brock when he was more of a wrestler, not a brawler. I loved it when he murdered Zach Gowen on SmackDown. Does that make me a bad person? Maybe it does. He was the greatest bully they ever had. He was the greatest heel bully that company ever had. But Brock is so much better now. He's such a star. He's an attraction. Much bigger than he was back then. Much, much bigger. And he only had Heyman with him for part of that original run. The Heyman-Lesnar combo, you know, it can't be beat. They're just so perfect together. So I'm all in on Brock Lesnar, the Conqueror, over Brock Lesnar, the Wrestler. And there's still so much potential there for him against new opponents. You know, Randy Orton, Cesaro, Kevin Owens. He signed a 3-year deal, so he's not going anywhere for a while. He can wrestle Undertaker at WrestleMania next year, if that's the plan, and then move on to newer faces. You know, they promoted an entire network special around the guy without even announcing on TV who his opponent was going to be. They just said, Brock Lesnar comes to Japan. And it did more viewers than any non-pay-per-view show ever on that network. The guy is must-see. He's older. He's smarter. He's got that character nailed down. He is the biggest star they have, by far, even bigger than John Cena. He is the biggest attraction they have. So, from a buy or sell perspective, a couple of different things. If I'm buying or selling as somebody who wanted Brock on my roster, would I want the old one or the new one? Even though this guy's older and he doesn't wrestle as much, I would want this one. And as a fan, I just think the Brock Lesnar of today is just so much better. It's just so much more polished than he was back then. But again, he was great back then. He was great from day one. Him and Kurt Angle both. Those amateur guys, I mean, maybe that's part of the reason why I think Chad Gable has such a bright future. I mean, the guy, I don't think he's been doing this very long. And, you know, he's not even on the main roster yet. But you watch him, and he's awesome in the ring. But even his character, it's like he's really nailing it down. And every time I see him on TV, he's very entertaining in a way that Kurt Angle was very entertaining when he first debuted. He was kind of a goof, but he could go. You know, people took him seriously. He wasn't a complete joke. And I think Chad Gable has the potential to be at that same level. You know, and I hope he makes it. And before we wrap up here, we have a late entry for this week's sad tweet. This literally came into me only a few minutes ago. From @HeelSteven on Twitter. It's a screenshot of a tweet that was sent by Kenny King, who is apparently, just judging by the photo, was at a UFC show. I know there was a UFC show last night, so I assume that's what this is from. He's at the show, mind you, and it's a photo of him looking into the camera, giving the middle finger to, I guess, UFC. And in his tweet, he tweeted this to @DanaWhite, and he said, I've almost died in the name of pro wrestling. Here's to fake fights. Yet he bought a ticket to go to the UFC show. It's been a while since we've had a dumb tweet from a TNA personality. I guess we were overdue for one, but not the dumbest I've ever seen, but still pretty dumb. If you have suggestions for sad tweet or mailbag questions, you can email me, thesolemonster @gmail.com, or you can tweet me your suggestions, @solemonster. Is my handle on Twitter. Don't forget to check out our Sound Off Extras channel on YouTube, youtube.com/thesolemonster. Please subscribe there. And don't forget our store, prowrestlingtees.com/solemonstersoundsoff. We've got over 20 different t-shirt designs up in the store right now, ready to ship to you all over the world, up to a size 5XL per shirt. That's one of a few different ways you can support this podcast. You can buy a shirt. You can use our Audible link to sign up for a trial and get your free Daniel Bryan book, audibletrial.com/solemonster, or make a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com. Or the best thing you could do is keep spreading the word and letting people know about the Sound Off if they've never heard it before. Give them a link to the website. Tell them to find us on iTunes, on Stitcher. We are available for streaming in the official Podbean app for iPhone and Android. We have our own Android app. I know some people have had issues with that. If it doesn't work for you, there's always at least 3 or 4 other ways that you can listen to the show. I've tried to make it so that if anybody has any kind of streaming issues or downloading issues one way, there's 3 or 4 other ways for you guys to listen to the show. Next weekend, September 13th, is episode 400 of the Sound Off. 400 episodes. I feel like I just did 300. I put the montage together for 300, and now it's 400. I mean, the summer is over already. It's the 20th anniversary of the debut of Nitro. Where the hell does time go? Jesus. This is terrible. I'm going to turn around one day and be 40. That's awful. I still got a ways to go. But we'll see you right here next week for episode 400. Until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you, as always, for the support and sticking with me. Some of you have been here for 399 episodes. I salute you. And we'll see you right back here next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always work. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.